Originally, I totally have changed a lot of things up. Sorry, Denise. I think originally she said, okay, what do you think about sharing on missionaries? And then I was talking to a friend recently, and I realized that, okay, because I talk about missionaries a lot. You guys probably know that. Anytime I've taught, I weave a missionary in somewhere into the story. But I was talking to my friend recently, and I realized from talking to her, because she knows a lot of missionary biographies, but other stuff too, and I realized after our conversation, it's like, man, it's also good to be reminded of Christians in other walks of life as well. Not just missionary, which are wonderful. There's so many wonderful missionary stories. But there's a lot of Christians in other walks of life through the centuries who have made an impact as well. And I thought, well, that might be kind of good because it can encourage those of us who are not called to go overseas as missionaries that God can use us in the sphere that we're in, you know, to be an influence where we're at, wherever that might be. It might be a sphere of influence that includes lots and lots of people. It might be a smaller sphere of influence. It doesn't matter. We can all be used. So even though I usually talk about missionaries, I decided to change it up, and we're just going to talk about Christians in other walks of life in general. And then I realized, I don't know, the other day that I think Denise might have announced that I was going to talk about women of faith. I'm actually going to throw a couple guys in there. So that was my other thing I messed up on. Sorry. So we're going to talk about, it's mostly women, but we're going to throw a couple guys in there too, because I just really wanted to share on these ones. So some of these stories you might have heard before from, you know, me, or maybe you've read about some of these before, but hopefully maybe you'll learn something new about them, even if you know these stories. So we are going to look at people from a wide spectrum here. We're going to look at a politician. We're going to look at an author, a mother of 12, a married couple, a housewife, and a blind lady. Okay, so we're going to kind of cover a really random group of people here that did a lot of different things. So we're going to start out with the politician, who happens to be one of my all-time favorites, and this is one of the guys that we're going to be talking about, William Wilberforce. Have you guys heard of William Wilberforce? Has anyone seen the movie Amazing Grace? Okay, the same people that raised their hands, that's right, okay. Awesome movie. I really strongly recommend it, since most of you haven't seen it. It's so good. So William Wilberforce had a really powerful voice in the British Parliament, and he used his voice most famously in the cause of the anti-slavery movement, as well as the promotion of morality in England. So he was born into a very wealthy, prestigious family, so he had an inside track to working in the government. And he actually had godly influence around him. There was some godly influence. He had an aunt and uncle who were really involved with George Whitefield and the Great Awakening and a lot of the revival that went around in England and America at that time. However, his immediate family, especially his mom, was afraid that her son was going to become a religious fanatic if he hung out with people like that. And that was just not cool back in the day. I mean, in England in the late 1700s, there were a lot of people who, especially in the upper classes, who were very churchy. But they didn't really want, you know, to get too involved in this whole evangelical movement and stuff. That was a little over the top. And so she actually encouraged him to just become a man of the world. And, you know, you don't have to encourage a young guy to do that too hard. He's like, okay, sweet, I will. So he attended Cambridge. He gained his seat in Parliament when he was only 21. Very young, but very, very intelligent and gifted. So he was physically, if you look at pictures of him, you can kind of tell he was weak and frail. He was small in stature and, you know, not physically very imposing, but he was very witty, very clever, very charismatic, very, very sharp, and a really good speaker. So people were really drawn to him. And he later admitted that at this time he was pretty much living for his own distinction and his own ambitions, trying to make a name for himself and to advance his prospects. And so that was what he was doing there in Parliament as a young man. But that all changed when he read a book that confronted him with the gospel. And he, like I said, he had had godly influences as a little boy, but he had kind of abandoned all of that. And now here it came back at him again. And he became, in his words, overwhelmed with a sense of my great sinfulness, having so long neglected the unspeakable mercies of my God and Savior. And so he gave his life to Christ right at that moment, no turning back. And he said that he saw clearly that if a man became a Christian, it should influence everything that he thinks and does. And, you know, that's how you know somebody really gets it, when they can realize that this is supposed to affect every area of my life. It's not supposed to be just like a sometimes thing or just making an appearance at church on Sunday mornings. In fact, he was so radically transformed from what he had been before that he cut off from all of the recreational stuff that he was doing, things that would be considered sinful back then, which would be things like going to the theater, but also smoking, gambling, stuff like that. He cut off all of that stuff, and he was on the verge of leaving Parliament because he really felt like if he stayed, he might fall into sin and compromise. He just didn't want to be in that environment. He didn't think it was very healthy for him to be there with his colleagues. However, he had a good friend and mentor, an older man named John Newton. Does anyone know who John Newton was? What did he do? I'm turning this into my classroom. He wrote Amazing Grace, all right? The hymn, right? The most famous hymn in history, really. John Newton wrote Amazing Grace, and his story in and of itself is amazing. I should probably tell that one sometime. But John Newton, when Wilberforce told him, you know, I'm going to back out of Parliament. Now that I'm a believer, I don't know if it's wise for me to be in there. But John Newton said to him, he wrote him a letter, and he said, "It is hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation." Basically, God has raised you up for such a time as this, and you can go ahead and, you know, walk away from it, but, you know, I see that God could really use you. And so Wilberforce made the choice to stay in Parliament, and God did use him in a really mighty way. It's amazing to, you know, it's kind of scary to think what would have happened if he hadn't stayed, as we'll see here. So, in fact, when he got saved, there were only two other genuine believers. There were a lot of churchy people, but only two other genuine believers in Parliament. But by the time he died, there were over 100 people. So that's saying something. That is largely due to his influence on everybody around him. I mean, we're going to see he just was a powerful testimony in the way he lived his life. And so I think that's a good encouragement to us. You know, I'm sure many of us have been tempted, whether it's in a job or even a ministry or some other situation that we are in, where we are tempted to get out of where the Lord has placed us. Whatever our occupation, whatever our sphere of influence, if God has placed us there, he has a purpose in it. And it's probably greater than we know right now, if we're in that kind of position at the moment where we're thinking like, man, is this really, do you really have me here, God? And we're kind of kicking against the goads. Stay and see what the Lord will do, because he sees the big picture. And we might be in that place for such a time as this, as Wilberforce was. He had no idea what was down the road. In that moment, but we can see, looking over the course of his life, how it was so important for him to stay where the Lord had placed him. And sometimes that's a good encouragement to us, to stay where the Lord has placed us, even if it's a little bit challenging. So, in 1787, Wilberforce wrote in his diary, "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners," which was like morals. And these became his life goals and the areas that God really gave him his greatest influence. And it was kind of like he just had a divine wind behind him for what God called him to do. He really was the man of the hour. So he began to stand on a lot of platforms to strengthen morality and ethics in English society. There was a lot of underlying immorality and perversity, especially in the upper classes and the aristocracy. A lot of complacency. People just didn't care. There was a lot of callousness toward the lower classes. And he wanted to reverse that and change that. And he succeeded. In fact, John Pollock, who's a biographer, he said, "Wilberforce touched the world when he made goodness fashionable." So he and then another gal who we're going to talk about in a little bit and a few other people, a lot of these people that were involved in the evangelical movement, they really made goodness like, you know, reach, like not, I mean, obviously, not just good works, but the Christian faith. They made it fashionable to the upper classes again, where the upper classes had been so selfish and, like I said, callous toward the lower classes. They really promoted, hey, let's reach out to those in need. Let's help the poor. Let's help the homeless. Let's be proactive in doing something about the social problems and dilemmas we see around us. And it worked. You know, he was able to basically turn the culture around. And we'll continue to see that. He supported up to 69 philanthropic organizations. He helped establish groups like the Church Missionary Society, the British and Foreign Bible Society, which is still in existence, and the Anti-Slavery Society. And that, fighting slavery, is actually what he's most well known for, even though he did all these other really significant things. At the time, here in the late 1700s, it was nearly impossible to get any laws passed against slavery. You know, it was so hard in England. I mean, and it was even harder in America to see anyone even think about the cause of the slaves. because it was such an entrenched part of the British economy and culture, you know, and racism was just such a, it was just kind of a prevalent thing that nobody even really, you know, cared about or took, you know, took, had a second thought for. Nobody really wanted to go there into that issue, the whole slave trade. And I think some people were starting to feel their conscience pricked by the treatment of the slaves, but nobody really wanted to touch that, especially in the government. It's like, hey, this is our economy. We can't go on. You know, what are we going to do without the slave trade? And so Wilberforce faced some pretty fierce opposition. I mean, almost like violent opposition from people, death threats. I mean, he just was hit, you know, he was really running up against a brick wall. Not only that, but he had really bad health. Like I said, he was frail just in general. He had some of the things he suffered from were bad eyes, ulcerated bowels, which sounds absolutely hideous, especially back then when they, you know, didn't know a lot of remedies for stuff like that. You just take laudanum and hope for the best, basically. So so he had ulcerated bowels. He had a curved spine. So he had a lot of, you know, back problems and things like that. I mean, the guy was constantly in pain, constantly suffering. Lots of sleepless nights. Of course, lots of burdens from dealing with the slave, the whole slave trade issue and stuff like that. And yet, in spite of all these things, his life basically said, none of these things move me. And he was actually described by many around him as a delightful and cheerful Christian. And he spoke of his self-denial as trifling sacrifices. These things are just, these are not really that big of a deal, you know. I think, man, what a G to be able to say that, to be able to just say, all these things I put up with, these are just not, these are nothing, really. They pale in comparison to Jesus' sacrifice for me, is essentially how he chose to view the things that he went through. And so for over 16 years, he saw bill after bill after bill after bill after bill against slavery defeated. His closest friend was actually the prime minister at the time, William Pitt, and he said Wilberforce had the greatest natural eloquence of all the men I ever knew, but he still had to persevere against opposition, slander, hatred, all of that. It didn't matter how eloquent he was. I mean, he gave a 3.5-hour speech that just brought the house down, but they still rejected his bill. I mean, there were these times over and over again, and times where you would think, oh man, he really got through to them this time. And yet nothing was ever enacted as far as these bills were concerned. And yet finally, like I said, after 16 plus years in 1807, finally Wilberforce won the day. Royal assent was given to the anti-slave trade bill, and slavery was then completely abolished in the British Empire through the Emancipation Act, July of 1833, right before he died. It was actually like 2 or 3 days before he died. They finally passed the Emancipation Act all across the British Empire. Pretty amazing. And so he was probably the greatest influence in what some historians have called one of the turning events in the history of the world. Okay, we're not even just talking about in the church or in Christian circles. We're talking about on the world scene. This was one of the most significant events. And so I mean, it was just, he was just such a critical force. Obviously other people were involved, but he played such a key role. Pollock said Wilberforce would disclaim the credit, but the essentials of his beliefs and his conscience formed the foundation of the British character for the next 2 generations at least. He was proof that a man may change his times, though he cannot do it alone. You know, and again, there were a lot of people that supported and encouraged and helped him in this, but amazing to think that he was able to change the culture, you know, for the next 2 generations and more. That was the kind of influence that he had. And one biographer said, how did Wilberforce manage to persevere in the face of such sustained hatred and character assassination? He established and sustained a lifetime of daily discipline. He knew the value of the first few hours of the day for Bible study, prayer, and mental preparation for the day. He surrendered his reputation to God early on. He did all that he could and then left the results in God's hands. His faith was resilient because it was not in himself, but in God alone. That's the key to his success. It really is not about Wilberforce and what a great man he was. Yes, the Lord gave him a lot of gifts and opportunities, but at the end of the day, he would have been just another, you know, charismatic speaker that had some gifts and talents that passed through Parliament and went on his way, like so many others that nobody's ever heard of. But because of his relationship with Jesus Christ, because of the fact that he surrendered his reputation to the Lord and just said, God, I commit all of this into your hands. I'm going to just keep following what you've called me to do. I mean, the perseverance and the tenacity that he had that nobody else around him would have had. I mean, that all came from Jesus Christ, from his relationship with the Lord. And that's what made him who he was and able to do all that he did. So He stayed in the sphere that the Lord had put him in, and God was able to move and to work in mighty ways. So that's our politician. Now we're going to go to a girl. Now we'll look at our author, and her name is Harriet Beecher Stowe. Another famous name associated with the slavery issue, actually, because she wrote the greatest anti-slavery novel in history, which is called Uncle Tom's Cabin. Some of you guys might be familiar with that. I don't think they read that in schools. They haven't probably read that in years. I think it probably has been banned in some instances, which is kind of lame in my opinion. But anyway, this book is so significant that historically only the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress have been more highly circulated. Of course, nowadays, you know, I think circulation of books is a lot more, things are so much more available, but for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, probably all the way up until the early 1900s, the most circulated books were the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Uncle Tom's Cabin. That's pretty amazing. Even one of her harshest critics said that Uncle Tom's Cabin was perhaps the most influential novel ever published, a verbal earthquake, an ink and paper tidal wave, because of the effect that it had. So Harriet was born in Connecticut in 1811 to a prominent theologian named Lyman Beecher. She got saved very young. Her family moved to Ohio when she was 21, and soon after this she met Calvin Stowe. They got married in 1836, and they lived in Ohio for the next 14 plus years. And it was during that time that Harriet was first exposed to the Underground Railroad, if you guys remember this from history way back, right? The Underground Railroad, which was kind of like this secret escape network for slaves that were trying to get up to the free North, you know, so they'd take the under. It wasn't like literally underground. I always thought that when I was a kid, like, wow, they had like a metro that just went like all the way down from Florida up to. But no, it just meant they called it the Underground Railroad, obviously, because it looked like the slaves went underground and disappeared because they were just gone. You know, they would hide them so well that they couldn't find them. So it was almost as if they went underground. So. It was the escape network for the slaves, and because the Stowes lived in a free northern town, they soon found out that the Underground Railroad was actually running like right down their street. They're like, oh, really? Whoa. So, and again, because there's a lot of secrecy involved, people probably had to make sure, you know, who was a friend and who was a foe. But when the Stowes found out about this, I mean, they were stoked to go and help out. They were like, oh, man, we would love to do what we can here to help the slaves. And so Harriet became very sympathetic to their plight, to their situation. And you got to imagine she's seeing all these men, women, and children, probably lots of scars on their backs from being beaten, you know, just so traumatized by some of their experiences. And so she really developed a heart and compassion for them, especially as a believer. You know, she's a Christian and she really believed, gosh, all men are created equal in the sight of God. We shouldn't be treating them this bad. This is just so wrong. And so Harriet always had a gift for writing. And one day her sister said to her, if I could use a pen as you can, I would write something that will make the whole nation feel what an accursed thing slavery is. Now, actually, Harriet didn't really respond to this. When her sister said that, she's like, yeah, I'm going to write a book that everybody's going to read. That's a, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree here. So she wasn't inspired at all. She just thought her sister was just being random and passionate. She's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. That's a nice idea. But shortly after this, she was in church, actually, and they were taking communion. And during the communion time, all of a sudden, the Lord gave her this vision of the death of a slave named Uncle Tom. I mean, she just pictured this whole scene in her mind as clear as day. And she knew it was from God. She was just like, whoa, what is this? Who is this person? What is this scene that I'm envisioning right now? So she was so impacted. She went home and she just basically based on that vision and then some of her experience she'd had with, you know, talking to the slaves and the Underground Railroad and all this stuff, she just scribbled a few notes on some sheets of paper and then she handed them to her husband. She's like, I don't know. You know what my sister said about me writing something. This is what I got. What do you think? So he starts reading it and he just starts crying. He's like, Harriet, this is a book. You need to write this. This is the Lord. And so that was the start of the whole thing. And that's pretty much how Uncle Tom's Cabin came into being. And it was an instant success. It turned Harriet into a celebrity almost overnight, pretty much. In 1852, I think. So she's like, what, 41 at the time. But in the midst of this whirlwind rise to fame, Harriet always gave credit to the Lord for writing the book. In fact, when people said that, like, well, what made you write this? She's like, well, I didn't actually write this book. God did. And she really meant that because she knew he was the one who gave her the vision for this. She wasn't really that excited to write anything down, right, until he gave her the vision. In fact, the gospel is presented very clearly in the story. I mean, she really laid it out there and made sure it honored the Lord. And so soon Uncle Tom's Cabin was not just a national success, it went international as well. And within a year, Harriet and her husband were invited to travel to England. She met everyone from Charles Dickens to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Kind of weird when you think of all these people being contemporary with each other. That's what I love. One thing I love about history, you're like, oh, they knew that person? Whoa, that's weird. So when she went back to the States, she found herself being pushed to the forefront of the anti-slavery movement because it was really gaining momentum. Again, this is we're getting into like the mid-1850s here. The Civil War started in 1860. So things are really escalating and heating up. The North is getting more and more vocal in talking about the evils of slavery and all that's going on. She drafted an anti-slavery petition to present to Congress. She, you know, continued crusading. Lincoln becomes president. The Civil War begins. She even countered Lincoln himself on one occasion in a newspaper. And apparently he was really impressed with her because when he met her sometime later, he said, so this is the little lady who made this big war. And it was kind of like a famous quote at the time. Quite a statement. I mean, he wasn't like blaming the war on her. Obviously, he was, you know, making a joke, but he's like, but still, he really kind of had a point there because Uncle Tom's Cabin was a major force. In fact, one historian said it was the wedge that finally rent asunder the gigantic fabric of American slavery with a fearful crash. And so when Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 to officially free the slaves, a lot of people cheered for Harriet because they knew that her book had been a driving force in bringing the slave issue to the forefront in society and in just in the culture in general and really driving that point home. And so she had a great influence on that. And yet I love how Harriet simply used the gift that God had given her, right? God's the one who gave her the vision, and he's the one who did the great work. All she did was make her gift available for God to use. And that's true with us. You know, whether we end up doing some grandiose thing or not, we never really know how God is going to use our gifts if we continue to just make them available for his service, even the simplest things, you know, whether it's a major thing or not, you know. And so a lot of people do have gifts. A lot of people in this church have gifts in writing and poetry and all kinds of things. I mean, God can use anything. Like we see here, she really had no idea this was going to skyrocket and become such a big deal. She just walked in the gifts that the Lord had given her. So that's our politician and our author. And now we're going to go to the mother of 12. And for anybody who came on Friday, I apologize because you already heard me talk about her a little bit. We're going to talk about Elizabeth Fry. Elizabeth Fry was, like I said, she was a mom, but she ended up, and this is just so weird when you read her story, it's like, man, here she is like trying to take care of all these kids. And then she somehow goes out and becomes England's most famous prison reformer. In fact, for a long time, she was on the 5-pound note. They recently came out with a new series of 5-pound notes with Churchill on it. So I'm not going to complain too much because I love Churchill. But the 5-pound note used to have Elizabeth Fry on it. So, I mean, she's pretty significant part of British history. So Elizabeth Fry was raised in a wealthy Quaker family. And in her early years, she really struggled with her, but, you know, she had just this constant war going on inside her, but the classic flesh versus spirit thing. You know, she really desired the things of God, but she also had such an attraction for worldly pursuits, you know, even just things like singing and dancing and stuff like that. But she was raised in a wealthy family, you know, I mean, that was a big draw for her. And so she went through a lot of emotional turmoil. She struggled with anxiety, with depression, a lot of these things, even from the time she was a little girl. I think it was after her mom died when she was pretty young. She just had this like horrible fear of death. Every time she got pregnant, she was just so terrified that she was going to die. And back then that could easily happen. I mean, we're talking, you know, late 1700s, early 1800s. It's not a given that your baby's going to be delivered fine. And so I remember the biography I was reading on her recently. I was just like, man, is she ever going to get through some of this? This poor girl. I was just so concerned for her. I'm like, man, Lord, just get her through, you know, to the next season of life here. I mean, she really struggled with a lot of things. But when she was 29, she had this major spiritual awakening, just a total breakthrough in her relationship with the Lord. And from that point, God just began to open doors for her. And as we're going to see, she always loved to serve the Lord in practical ways. From the time she was a little girl, she loved going with her mom to hand out food baskets to the poor and the homeless. And she really was drawn to the mentally ill. She really had a heart for them. That's not natural, you know, for most people, right? So that's like a God-given just compassion, even before she really had a relationship with the Lord, for people that were, you know, marginalized and needy and, you know, just kind of on the outskirts of society. And that really became a trademark of a relationship with him, just that desire to reach out to the poor and the marginalized, to reach out to practically help and meet those needs. And so she married Joseph Fry in 1800. She was 20 years old, and she started a family. And then years later, in 1812, after she'd had this spiritual awakening in her life, a family friend visited the women's section of Newgate Prison in London, and he was horrified by what he saw in there. I mean, a lot of, you know, the prisons, nobody really knew what went on in the prisons back then. Oh gosh, I could launch into a whole thing on the Industrial Revolution. But during the 17 and 1800s in Britain, there was just such a influx of people coming into the cities, and there was, you know, to work in factories and mills, and it just created all kinds of, you know, societal problems, right? People, you know, if you have a lot of people concentrated in one spot, you're going to have a lot of people problems and a lot of issues. You're going to have homelessness. You're going to have you're going to have prostitution and drunkenness and lack of sanitation and health issues. And, you know, they had a lot of kids working in the factories with no child labor laws. So there's exploitation of the workers in the factories. Lots of diseases. It was just a really, really gnarly scene, and the prison system was no different. They would just throw everyone in there and not really give any attention to the need, like how the prisoners were doing and whether they were justly even in the right place and stuff like that, or being treated fairly. And it was just a really, really gnarly scene. I'll describe it in a second here. So he described this guy went to Elizabeth, to the Fry's house, and was talking to them like, man, you won't believe what I just saw over at Newgate. The women's section is disgusting. It's terrible in there. And so he described it to her, and she decided she needed to go in and see it for herself. And when she did, she was absolutely shocked. So what she saw at Newgate Prison was 300 women and children crammed into four rooms that could barely fit all of them. So you had a lot of times, this is part of the problem with the Industrial Revolution. It was such a revolution and such a term, what's the word I'm looking for? Not spontaneous, but it was just such a sudden change and shift in the culture that nobody was equipped to handle all of these problems. And so what they ended up doing was, if you had women that had to go to prison and maybe their husband had died or was out of the, or they weren't married or out of the picture or whatever, they would just take the woman and the kids and throw them in prison together. There weren't any laws about this. Nobody had like set up any kind of provision for the children. So they're like, well, we just got to throw them all in together. So it was totally chaotic and haphazard, not a good scene at all. So they're crammed into four rooms. And not only that, but like I said, they didn't really have proper justice going on. You'd have women that were basically innocent. They just maybe couldn't pay their debts. So they'd get thrown into what was called debtor's prison. But they'd be placed right alongside hardened criminals, murderers, prostitutes, these people that, you know, actually belong there. And then you have these women and their kids, like, terrified, huddled in the corner because they, you know, really probably should have been handled in a different way than being thrown in the clink with all these other people. So, you know, you've got women that are just, that were drunk and filthy. Some of them were so nasty and tough that even the male prisoners were kind of shocked by them. Like, whoa, you're a little bit too much. And you had gross things going on. The prison wardens sometimes would come in for sexual favors from women that, you know, were totally defenseless in there. You know, it was really creepy, really dirty, horrific stuff going on. And again, probably the worst part was that there were so many children in this toxic environment with their moms. They had to sleep on the floor like everyone else. There were newborn babies lying naked on the floors of these cold, cold cells, hard floors. In one instance, Elizabeth saw two ladies taking the clothes off of a dead baby to put onto another baby that was still alive. So they're just scavenging around. I mean, and living basically like animals. I mean, when she walked in, she, you know, for the first time, she was just horrified at what she saw. It was, I'm not even going to get into the details because it was pretty nasty. Quote, there's a quote from one of her biographers. Bathing utensils were scarce. Lice swarmed in clothes and hair. The daily ration of food was one small loaf of bread per person. There were no medicines. Sick women were dumped on dirty straw without so much as a bed. Death by prison fever or typhoid was common. So this was not a good scene at all. So if you walked into a scene like that, you'd be kind of overwhelmed, right? I think that might be a little overwhelming. So Elizabeth was overwhelmed too when she walked in. But what did she do? She started with something practical. She looked around her and she said, okay, I can meet a need here. I could bring clean straw in for them to sleep on. I could bring clothes to these women. You know, instead of trying to like take on the whole justice system, she just started to meet one need at a time. She's like, okay, this is what I can do, how I can help right now practically. Like I said, she had a very practical relationship with the Lord, and this is how it manifested itself. So she and a few other women began to come in, and they'd bring clothes for the babies. They'd bring clean straw for the women to sleep on and food. And by the third time that Elizabeth visited, the women began to see, wow, this woman actually kind of cares about us. You know, she genuinely is concerned, and she's not just trying to do a good deed and walk away, because there were a lot of people who did that, you know, in the upper classes. Like, oh, I did my good deed for the month. I brought a food basket to this poor family. Now I can just go and live however I want. But no, she actually continued to come. And so they even let her pray for them after a few visits. And what was really important was the fact that when Elizabeth addressed them, she included herself in the conversation. In fact, one of her biographers describes one of her early visits into the prison, and the women are all just looking at her like, who are you and what are you doing in here? And some of them are even coming up close to her to try to intimidate her. And what did she do? She just looked around, saw one of the kids, picked him or her up, and said, what are we going to do for these children, ladies? Now, it was just simply the fact that she said we, that's what melted their hearts. Just the fact that she said, what are we going to do? Not what are you doing for these kids, but what are we going to do to help them? That made all of the difference. And they realized, whoa, she's on our team. She's on our side. She's for us. And so that totally opened up their hearts. They responded so well to her desire to help them that she was able to start a school for the kids, reform activities for the women. And I love this. She's not like, all right, prison break, let's all get out of here. She's like, no, you guys are in here. Let's do something, you know, while you're here in this situation, let's try to deal with it, you know, with the conditions as they are and improve them. And so she taught them to sew quilts, to make things to sell for food, other necessities that weren't being provided by the prison guards. But most importantly, because Elizabeth had provided practical help for these women, it opened an effective door for the gospel. And so she and her friends, they started coming in every single day and they began to read the Bible to the women. That's what they would just sit and read the Bible. The women are, you know, learning how to sew and do these different things, or they'd come and just gather around and sit and listen. And she would read the Bible and talk about how we are all sinners, all have sinned. Again, not looking down her nose at them and acting as if they were just so beyond the grace of God, but including herself with them as needing God's love and forgiveness and grace. And so that the gospel really began to transform their lives. And she knew that alone was the key. That was the answer. She said nothing short of the Holy Spirit can really help forward the cause of righteousness on earth. And she knew that was the only way that any lasting work was going to get done here. And so by simply presenting God's word to the women, he began to move. And it wasn't long before people began to take notice that something was going on in the women's prison. Like, wow, there's something crazy happening in there. You know, I mean, where before you'd come in and the women are, you know, brawling and drunk and cussing each other out. Now the prison wardens come in and the women are sitting and sewing and talking. It's like, what the heck happened in there? Am I like in a drawing room in West London? Where are we? So it was kind of freaked out all of the prison guards and stuff like that. And so pretty soon the English authorities, the government started to get involved, and the prison governor, the Lord Mayor of London, all of these notable figures were coming in to hear Elizabeth's Bible readings. That became one of the most popular things that she did. Like, a lot of people would come to hear her Bible readings at the prisons. And so simply because she was obedient to the Lord in simple things, he began to open even more doors. By 1818, she was being invited to the House of Commons, which is like our House of Representatives, to give evidence on the state of London's prison as an expert witness, basically. I mean, pretty crazy here. This is, again, just a little housewife, a little Quaker housewife. And she's coming in as an expert on the prison system. Eventually, a member of the House became a big supporter of her work and came alongside her to start legislating reforms in all the prisons, not just in London. So pretty crazy. And this is a very unique situation. Women were not commonly part of the sociopolitical world like this at that time. And this was a very unique situation. Again, God raising her up for such a time as this. In fact, I think probably if her husband hadn't been so supportive, I'm sure she would not have had the liberty or the opportunity that she did. He was a pretty remarkable guy. He wasn't as, from what I've read, I don't think he was even as strong of a Christian as she was. He wasn't super dynamic and he was kind of into like comfortable things, but he didn't mind if she went out and did that. He appreciated her. He admired her. So he's like, yeah, you go ahead, honey. I mean, it's pretty amazing because most guys would not have let their wives do that in the early 1800s. That's almost impossible. So even in that, you see the hand of God in opening the door and making an opportunity for her. So by now, she had established an organization for the women at Newgate, and it seemed that God wanted to expand the work. Eventually, she set up visiting societies and reforms in prisons all over England, Scotland, Europe. And she was such a visionary. She set up societies to work with the poor, improve facilities for the mentally ill. She developed a training school for nurses. I mean, she was just constantly seeing needs and seeing ways that those needs could be met. And her work inspired many other women to do the same. So by now, Elizabeth Fry was quite well known across the nation and across Europe. French, Belgian royalty, even Queen Victoria met with her on several occasions. It's really kind of amazing. And yet, in spite of the fame and the honor given to her, she always left people with a clear understanding that this was the Lord's work. Again, like Harriet Beecher Stowe, she wanted it to be really clear that God was the one that was making all of the difference. She told the House of Lords in 1835, "I feel it to be the bounden duty of the government and the country that the truths in the Bible should be administered in the manner most likely to conduce to the real reformation of the prisoners. For though severe punishment may in a measure deter them and others from crime, it does not amend and change the heart." Amen. You know, she realized the gospel is what's going to change society. That's what's going to change hearts and lives. That's what we need, is to make sure that the Bible stays at the foundation of all of this reform work. And so I just love Elizabeth Fry. And I know all of this sounds so spectacular, what she was able to do. But remember how it all started. Meeting simple, basic needs. She didn't become a leader in prison reform by tackling society's problems. And I'm going to go and I'm going to do all this. She started right in her little sphere, right there in London, in her one little corner of the world, in that one little prison. And then from there, the Lord did the work. He opened the doors for her. So I love Elizabeth Fry because she was just a simple little Quaker mom who saw a need, stepped out to meet it, and God was the one who took it from there. And you see that with, you know, virtually every life that we look at in you know, the great men and women of the faith that we've seen through the centuries. That's something anyone can do, though, is just, you know, step out in our little sphere, whatever that looks like, whatever God puts on our heart. And so that's our mom, Elizabeth Fry. Now let's look at a married couple that helped the poor, and their names were William and Catherine Booth. Have you guys heard of these guys? Maybe? Okay. All right. These guys are one of the most famous couples in church history. It's been said no one family ever spread the gospel farther or more effectively than the Booths. So they were a real powerful tag team, we're going to see. But God used them individually as well. So I'm going to look at them individually here. Starting with Catherine, she grew up in a Christian home in England, and she made a personal commitment to Jesus when she was 17. She married William Booth when she was 26 in 1855. And as William went into ministry, Catherine found herself being kind of prompted by the Lord. As she would walk to church on Sundays, she was really prompted to reach out to some of the down-and-out folks that she saw, like, you know, people begging for money and stuff on the streets. And she really just, her heart went out to them. She wanted to share the Lord with them and try to help them in some way practically and meet their needs. And it actually kind of reminded me, the Booth story reminds me a little bit of, from what I understand, what Pastor Chuck and Kay were, how they got, you know, really, how the Lord really launched them out, right? Because isn't the story that Kay was the one who had the heart for the hippies, right? She was the one who really had that heart to reach out to the hippies. And then, you know, obviously Pastor Chuck began to, you know, have them have Bible studies and stuff like that as well. And they all started coming in. But that's kind of like what the Booth story is. It started with Catherine's heart for the down and outers and for the poor and the needy. And her compassion for the underprivileged was what really paved the way for the emphasis of their ministry later on. So eventually, the Booths founded something called the East London Mission as an outreach to the homeless, an outreach to the poor and needy in London. But in 1878, about 10 years after that East London Mission started, this mission became known as something else. Does anyone know? Whoa, Salvation Army. Very good, guys. The Salvation Army. One of the most influential ministry organizations in history. Now, a lot of times people just think it's the Santas that ring the bell and have that little pot, you know, out front of the, you know, thrift store or something like that. But and it's kind of sad that people think of the Salvation Army as just being a thrift store now or something like that. But I mean, gosh, it's actually been a really, really significant ministry organization over the last 150 years. So in 1860, during a church service, the Lord prompted Catherine to get up and speak in the middle of the church service. So this is kind of one area of her ministry that sometimes doesn't get talked about, but is kind of significant. So she gets this, you know, like the Holy Spirit just telling her, I want you to share a word. And she's resisting and like, I can't get up and do this. My husband's preaching right now. This would be so weird. So she's sitting there in the service fighting with the Lord over whether or not she should get up and speak. And then finally she's like, okay, fine. So she stands up and starts walking down the center aisle toward him as he's speaking. And so he looks at her and he's like, okay, maybe one of the kids got sick and she just, it's an emergency. Why is she doing this? So he's just talking and she comes up to the front. She's like, hi, honey, is everything okay? And she's like, I'd like to say a word. And he's like, okay, my wife wants to say a word, everyone. So he steps away from the mic. Well, they didn't have a mic, sorry, from the pulpit, the lectern, whatever it was. And she steps forward and the Lord just fills her mouth basically with this word. She starts speaking and it was so moving and so powerful. People are crying. And so when she got done, she looked over at her husband and he jumps up and comes over to the podium and he says, well, thank you, Catherine. And guess what, everybody? My wife's going to be speaking tonight as well. I mean, he just sensed that this was the Lord. And so he said, she's going to speak tonight at the evening service. And she's like, what? I am? I mean, she wasn't expecting this at all. And so he was super supportive of her, very enthusiastic about this gift that his wife had that nobody even knew about. So Catherine goes on to become a very well-known speaker all over England, which was very unique in that day and age, not very normal. In fact, later when William wrote up the orders and regulations for the Salvation Army, he said this. He said, women shall have the right to an equal share with men in the work of publishing salvation. And that made, was one of the many things that made the Salvation Army very distinct was the fact that, and it's kind of like the Quakers, actually, they really allowed women to be very involved in a lot of the ministry that they did and proclaiming the gospel and stuff like that. So pretty unique situation there. Now, she became so well known and was considered by many to be a better speaker than her husband, but Catherine remained very humble and you know, really submissive about the whole thing in the sense that she always just made sure, like, hey, honey, are you okay with this? I never want to, like, and she had a strong personality. If you read the story of their marriage and stuff, they were butting heads all the time because she had a pretty strong personality, but she was very wise and she didn't want to, you know, put a strain or friction or tension in the marriage. She basically stayed under his covering, you could say, right? As he was the pastor, but he was so encouraging to her and wanted her to speak all the time. So it's like, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. And so they became a real team in ministry, even in their speaking opportunities. So she really was wanting to walk in obedience to the Lord and stay, again, sensitive to the Spirit, submitted to what he wanted her to do. But it was because of Catherine stepping out into ministry as a woman, speaking and working with the poor and needy, just very much out there in the streets with them, that it really encouraged many other young working class women in England to do the same. It really inspired a lot of other gals because, you know, at that time, again, not only was Elizabeth Fry unique for what she was doing in the prisons, but you wouldn't normally see well-bred young women going out and, you know, hanging out on the streets with homeless people and prostitutes and stuff like that. You guys might remember even Lilias Trotter's story, which I've shared before, and how she, as an upper-class woman, going and trying to rescue prostitutes was completely, like, anathema. Like, we don't do that in our society. You're a cultured, well-bred woman. You stay away from those people. But the fact that, you know, these gals were willing to go and, you know, reach out and not care about what society thought of them, it really emboldened and encouraged other women who had that same heart and that same desire to reach out and help those in need. And so God really used her to inspire a generation, and God used these women to spread the gospel and influence society through the Salvation Army all through the late 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, it was a really, really powerful work of the Spirit is what it was. And so the Lord obviously used William as well. So moving on to his story for a second, he was actually known as the prophet of the poor. He'd been born into poverty himself. He had to start working when he was 14 to help support his family. When he was 15, he got saved and he surrendered his life to the Lord saying, God shall have all there is of William Booth. And so he and his friends soon went out and they were evangelizing. They were holding open air meetings. calling people to repent and be saved, and then they'd go and visit the sick, they'd go and visit their converts. I mean, they were very proactive in the community. William's motto was always go for souls and go for the worst. And that is really literally what he did. I mean, he didn't just say that as like an inspirational motto. He really lived that out. He would go to the worst, the dregs of society, to try to win people to Christ, to try to rescue not only their physical bodies, but their souls. Eventually, William became a Methodist pastor, but by the time he and Catherine got married and had been married for, I think 5 or 6 years, he felt led to minister outside the denomination. So in 1861, the Booths actually left the established church and became itinerant evangelists throughout the UK. And in 1865, they began to accept support from missions in East London. So that's where they focused on ministering. Like I said, they started the East London mission. And at that time, again, this is the Industrial Revolution when things are pretty chaotic in society. East London was the armpit of London. And I know this, my parents live there. That's where they have their church. I think you guys know my parents are missionaries. And so that's where they are. They're in East London. And there's even a lot of old, you can even see remnants of how it used to be still. But at that time, during the Industrial Revolution, East London was, quote, a squalid labyrinth with 500,000 people. Every fifth house was a gin shop. Most had special steps to help even the tiniest children reach the counter. So they would, and it's not even just that there was alcohol. I mean, there was like, a lot of just bad stuff everywhere. It was not a warm, fuzzy place to minister, especially a place where, like that quote says, you got little kids going in and getting liquor and getting drunk. I mean, it was a really chaotic situation. There weren't a lot of laws to help people and protect them and that kind of a thing. It was just chaotic. Most of these people were workers that were being exploited and used in the factories and dying young. There were a lot of prostitutes for the sailors that were coming into port, because East London is where the Thames River comes in from the sea. And so it was just a really dirty, nasty place. And yet, this was where, William and Catherine felt called to go. And they stepped out to try to help these people in spite of mockery, even their own poor health. They both had really bad health. They struggled with depression, all kinds of things. But you read their story and it's like, man, this puts us comfy Christians to shame in some ways. Because, just the fact that they... not only were they willing to go to the marginalized and those in need, but they themselves had their own struggles and issues physically that they were dealing with. And yet they were willing to try to overcome those for the sake of those that they felt were needier than themselves, those whose souls were in danger. One quote says, "This delicate, ill-educated man married to a very sick woman stood by himself on Mile End Waste and was pelted with garbage by the drunkards who reeled out of their gin palaces to deride and mock them." So it wasn't even like they had a warm and captive audience. I mean, people were like throwing stuff at him and making fun of them. But William was compelled to go on and try to reach these people. He said to his wife, "I seem to hear a voice sounding in my ears. Where can you go and find such heathen as these? And where is there so great a need for your labors?" And so he really believed that, like Elizabeth Fry, practical ministry to try to help and reach out to the poor and the destitute and the working classes would really help open the doors for evangelism and the spreading of the gospel. And that's exactly what happened. Many people's lives were transformed, not just physically, but spiritually, through the ministry of William and Catherine Booth in a really powerful way. And so the mission was established. And once William changed it to the Salvation Army, it really got people's attention. Within 10 years, the Salvation Army was established in the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and it marches on today. William once said, this is one of my favorite quotes. I love this. He said, "While women weep as they do now, I'll fight. While little children go hungry, I'll fight. While there's a drunkard left, while there's a poor lost girl on the streets, where there remains one dark soul without the light of God, I'll fight. I'll fight to the very end." And I always tell my students, my Bible college students, because this is what challenges me. It's like, man, to have that heart to fight, yes, in the physical, but I even think in the spiritual realm. It's like, Lord, am I willing to even fight for the souls of my family members and friends? Or do I get lazy in my prayer life and like, they'll never come around? Lord, give me that spirit even just to fight in my prayer life, as well as obviously to go and minister to those in need, minister to those who... are marginalized, but to really reach out. But gosh, even Lord, help me in my prayers to fight to the very end and not to give up on people. And so I love the Booths. Next, moving on, where are we at? Okay, we're getting there, guys. I'm actually going faster than I thought I was going to go. So we're getting there. We only have a couple more people left. So Next, we have our housewife, who is actually a nun-turned housewife, and her name was Katharina von Bora. And she's better, she was known as a quick-witted Saxon with a ready tongue, but she's better known as the wife of the father of the Protestant Reformation, who is Martin Luther. Okay, this is Martin Luther's wife we're talking about here. So, Katie, I don't want to say Katharina over and over again, that's annoying. So, Katie was born to a noble family, but they fell on hard times. So when she was 5 years old, she was sent to a convent. That happened a lot in families where, you know, if a family just, like I said, fell on hard times or something, a lot of times if they had too many kids, they would send some of them to the convents or monasteries because that's a good, safe, healthy environment for my children to be raised in. At least they're, you know, getting godly training and all that sort of a thing. So she's in the convent, and she became a nun when she was 16. When she was 18, it was 1517. It was the year 1517. She turns 18, and that just so happened to be the year that Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses. Revolutionary moment in history. Again, this was not just something that affected church history, but all of Western civilization and history as a whole, when Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses and started this whole thing we call the Protestant Reformation, a breakaway from the established church at the time, which we now know as the Catholic Church. Katie was born. So Katie's there in the convent, and she gets a hold of these tracts that Martin Luther was writing. After he posted the 95 Theses, he started authoring these religious tracts dealing with the monastic life, and he started telling people how being a monk or being a nun is not some higher calling, because that's during the Middle Ages what everybody thought. Like, if you really are spiritual and really want to serve the Lord, you go to a convent, you go to a monastery. And all the other common people, they don't have as close of a relationship with God as you do. But he said, no, that's not a higher calling. You don't earn greater favor with God because you joined a convent or something. Salvation is by faith, not by our works. And therefore, you know, anybody can be sanctified and set apart to serve God in any calling, in any vocation. So he's writing these tracts, and they're circulating around, and they really bore witness with the hearts of many nuns and monks, and who started just abandoning their, you know, cloistered lives, you know, away from society, and they started going out and living in society, getting married and settling down and getting jobs and, you know, just living normal lives. And so, I mean, this was a massive, I mean, that in and of itself was a massive transformation in society, because all of a sudden you have these people. I always picture all of these monks and nuns just like running out of the convents and monasteries, freedom, you know, and hitting the streets and freaking everybody out. But I mean, that was a major societal change, because now it's like, whoa, we got to find jobs for all these people, and what are we going to do? And they're like, you know, going and start getting married and starting families, and there's like all this stuff happening. So the excitement of the Reformation, the excitement of all of these people leaving the monasteries and convents to go and serve God in other ways, it soon spread to the convent that Katie was in. Like I said, she got a hold of one of these tracts, and so she and her friends, they read this, and it really bore witness with them, like, man, I can serve the Lord in another way. I can get a normal job like other people. I could get married and have a family and still serve the Lord. I want out of here too. So they wrote to Luther and asked himself, and they asked for his help in escaping the convent. It was a very well-guarded facility, and nobody was allowed to leave. And I think that was probably, they probably put a lot of rules and regulations down once all of these other convents and monasteries started emptying out. I think that, you know, they started trying to put a clamp down on it. So nobody's exactly sure how all of this came together, but basically on the night of April 7th, 1523, Katie and 11 other nuns escaped. And this was a very brave thing for them to do. If they would have been caught, the punishment was death. I mean, they would have been executed for leaving the monastery or for leaving the convent. Kind of crazy. So three of these gals returned to their families, and then the other nine, including Katie, hid in fish barrels on a delivery wagon en route to Wittenberg, which was the town that Martin Luther lived in. And so they were basically deposited on Martin Luther's doorstep. You know, that's what they said, like, just drop us off at Martin Luther's house. The guy's like, okay. So takes them in these fish barrels, drops them off, you know. So Luther comes out to get his morning paper, and there's nine women standing on the doorstep. Peace be with you, Brother Martin, you know. There they are, just hanging out, probably smelling like fish. And he's like, what the heck am I supposed to do with these girls? So he's given the task. He kind of felt responsible for them because it was his writings that had inspired them to leave. And so he is given the task of finding work or finding husbands for these poor women. And that was not an easy thing to do. None of them were trained for any job. One historian said all these women could do was pray and sing. They couldn't really do much. And as far as marriage was concerned, back then, again, we're talking 1500, so most girls were married by 15 or 16 years old, and I think these gals were all in their 20s at least, 20s or 30s, so they're considered, whoa, past their prime. There's no hope for you. And so, you know, it was a pretty dire situation for them. Luther felt really sorry for these gals, but with his help, somehow he was able to find husbands or jobs for all of the women except for one, old Katharina von Bora, right? Katie. And he did his best. You know, he's figured, okay, I got a good track record here. I'm bad at, you know, I'm 8 for 9 here. I've got one girl. I can surely, you know, pawn her off on some guy out here. So he did his best to try to set her up. But when he suggested a 60-year-old pastor, she was like, that's it. I'm drawing the line. And she was a very feisty girl, as we're going to see here. And so she said, no, wait a minute. You can't just throw me at some old man. And Luther complained that she couldn't afford to be so picky at this point. It's like, hey, everybody else is taken care of except you. So at this point, this is probably what you're going to get is this guy. But so she was really upset with him. And so she was talking to a friend one day and she said, you know what? I have my own, I know my own mind. I can actually, you know, think for myself. And I have two choices of my own for men that I would want to marry. And one of them happened to be Luther himself. So news got back to Luther that Katie thought she would be willing to marry him. Not because she thought he was hot or something like that. She just thought, you know, well, at least he's not like 60. Good grief. You know, he's still, you know, in his prime, more or less. And so news gets back to Luther that Katie had said this, and it was actually good timing because there were a lot of rumors going around town because, you know, Martin Luther has all these nuns hanging out at his house. It's like, yeah, right, what the heck's going on over there? A little shady. His parents were also starting to, you know, pressure him because they were thinking, oh, son, now that you've broken with the monastic life, why don't you get married and settle down and carry on the family name? And so there's pressure from family and just from the rumors around town. Also, he had been teaching for years now that marriage was this blessed institution, that it was, you know, just as valid as singleness. And so maybe he figured it was time to start practicing what he preached. So, you know, all those things kind of combined to make him think, well, if she's down, I'm down. I guess we should just go for this. And so Martin married Katie on June 13, 1525. He was 41 and she was 26. And so when talking about the sudden, surprising nature of their marriage, Luther's joked, I can hardly believe it myself, but the witnesses are too strong. So, I mean, it was just sort of out of nowhere. Neither of them were expecting this. It was a very unusual match. It was not a love match by any means. They were not, like, so in love with each other or anything like that. But I love their marriage. I love their relationship. They grew to really love each other and appreciate each other as the years went by. In fact, this unexpected union became kind of the model of Protestant marriage that people were looking to. You know, everybody's looking at Martin Luther. He's kind of the figurehead of the Reformation, so he's kind of their example for, okay, well, what do we do now? You know, if we're going to break away from the church, which has controlled society for 1,000 years, we kind of need some direction here from the Bible on what we should do, and you're the one who kind of got this whole thing going. And so, you know, marriage was one of those many things that people looked to him as an example in. And so his marriage to Katie ended up kind of becoming a model, and people looked to that like, this is what a Christian marriage looks like. Outside of the Catholic Church. So kind of amazing. And they really met their match with one another. They were both very outspoken and strong-willed. Martin was moody and had a violent temper. Katie had a sharp tongue. But they were willing to learn and willing to try to make it work. So from the beginning, she was a real support and asset to him. She immediately began to bring his affairs into order and his life in general. He was an old bachelor. He was super set in his ways. But this is where she was able to assert her strong personality and start managing the household and managing him. Actually, one biographer said that of Katie. She ruled both her household and her husband, a situation which the latter accepted resignedly since he was totally incapable of organizing the affairs of even the smallest household. She brought order into his life and not always to his satisfaction. And they really had strong personalities, like I said, so it was not uncommon for some kind of drama to erupt every now and then. And I'm going to just tell you a couple stories about this. We're almost done. I'm trying to hurry. Are we okay? Are you guys just go to the bathroom if you're getting tired and need to get up or whatever. Okay. Okay, Martin was accustomed to the monastic life. He was used to being by himself for hours, even days on end. And he didn't, you know, it was hard for him to learn to work with people around him, especially once they started having kids. So one time he locked himself in his study for 3 days until Katie came in and had some carpenters come and remove the door, basically. She just had the, like, door completely removed and taken outside. And when he saw her standing there, he's like, why did you do that? I wasn't doing any harm. I'm just in here. I mean, he really did not have a clue that he was supposed to interact, you know, and that he couldn't just lock himself up for days. So she really asserted herself into his life. He had to learn to adjust to that and be patient with her. But he was a pretty difficult person himself. He had a lot of mood swings and sometimes poor health. Sometimes he exaggerated it. I know, we all know men can be kind of babies when they're sick, right? So he was one of those really bad ones. It was just like, oh my gosh, please get over it. So one story talks about how Luther was in a bad mood for several days. He was just like grumbling and just complaining about everything and moody. And it went on for so long that finally Katie started wearing mourning clothes, dressing in black as if she was in mourning with a veil and everything, walking around the house really quietly. And, you know, he noticed that she was doing this after a while and he started to get kind of irritated. And so finally he's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? What are you trying to say? And she's like, oh, I'm sorry, you're acting like God is dead, so I thought I was supposed to dress appropriately for the occasion. So totally got him. He snapped out of his depression immediately. So, I mean, she really could just get him, you know. One more story. They had a lot of university students, because he was a university professor, coming to his house to discuss theology and ask questions. And so Katie was constantly playing hostess to all of these people that came through the door. Not surprisingly, the dinner table became a scene for squabbles as well. In fact, one time Katie contradicted Martin in front of the dinner guests, and he said, if I ever should marry again, I would hew myself an obedient wife out of stone. Like, I wouldn't want somebody who could actually talk back to me. So anyway, for all their bickering, they actually really appreciated and loved each other, and to the watching world, they showed what a committed Christian marriage looked like, for better or for worse. And they really grew in their similarities and differences to really shape and mature their character. So Martin died in 1546. Without question, his marriage to Katie was what God used to make him the man that he was. She had a really great impact on his thinking, his ministry, his character, everything in his life. And you can see that from some of his writings and stuff like that. He actually called the book of Galatians, which was the book that was of the Bible that was closest to his heart, he called it his Katie von Bora. So that was like a theologian's way of complimenting someone. So better than being called the book of Leviticus. So Katie had a rough go of it after Martin died. The plague was breaking out. There was wars between the Protestants and Catholics. So she fell from a wagon, actually fleeing Wittenberg at one point, never fully recovered, died December of 1552. Her last words were, I will stick to Christ as a burr to a top coat. but I like that. Encouraging reminder to even the wives and moms in here. People are watching you to see what marriage and family can look like with Christ at the center. It has a huge influence, and you can just, you know, just ask Katie Luther, because that was really where she had her influence, was in the home. People watching how she and her husband conducted their marriage as believers, and it made a huge, huge impact. So finally, last but not least, stay with me here, guys. We're going to bust through this. We have our blind woman, okay? A hymn writer named Fanny Crosby. Some of you guys might have heard of her, and the Lord really used her to edify the church in a powerful way. It's been actually said that she set more hearts and voices to praising God than any other woman who ever lived. Probably true. She wrote 8,000 to 9,000 hymns. If you stacked 15 hymnals on top of each other, that's about how many hymns she wrote. Pretty narnar. So, and some of these are still sung today, some of the songs that she wrote. Does anybody know a song by Fanny Crosby? An old hymn? Oh, you got this. Come on, guys. What? But boom, Denise knows all this. Yes, Blessed Assurance, Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior, To God Be the Glory. We sung that all the time in the Free Methodist Church growing up. Safe in the Arms of Jesus, All the Way My Savior Leads Me. So a lot of these ones. I'm trying to think. They just, the one on the hymns thing that Scott and the guys did, Chaz did one of Fanny Crosby's hymns, and I can't remember what it's, anyway, it's escaping me right now. What's the one Chaz did? All Will Be Well? Is that it? Okay, yeah. That's another one she did. All right. Thank you. Good thing you're here, Allie. So she was born March of 1820 in Putnam County, New York. When she was 6 weeks old, she got an eye infection, and this quack doctor came in and said, oh, we need to put hot poultices on her eyes. This is a six-week-old baby. So, I mean, the heat obviously cleared up the infection, you know, but it left her with all of this scarring on her eyes and left her permanently blind. So from her youth, even though, you know, she had a very, you would think, a very difficult uphill battle ahead of her, but she was surrounded by godly influences, and her grandma played a huge role in raising her to love the Lord and spend time in prayer. She read and explained the Bible to Fanny. So amazingly, as she grew up, Fanny never became bitter about her blindness. She just accepted it from the Lord. When she was only 8 years old, this is what she wrote, and this was her very first poem, but this is just profound and amazing. "Oh, what a happy child I am, although I cannot see. I am resolved that in this world contented I will be. How many blessings I enjoy that other people don't. So weep or sigh because I'm blind, I cannot, nor I won't." Isn't that amazing? This is an 8-year-old kid, and she just got it. She just said, hey, I have so many other, you know, things going for me. And so, I mean, talk about learning to be, you know, thankful in all things. I mean, she really was always finding something to be grateful for and not to focus on what she didn't have. So, I mean, it's all about perspective. And Fanny Crosby is one of the, you know, biggest examples of that, I know, to me. So she was very clever and optimistic. She was very intelligent. And we're going to see, like, the Lord really gave her a good mind. And I love that, how, yeah, maybe she couldn't see, but the Lord gave her a lot of other really significant gifts. She had a real zest for life. She learned to climb trees, ride horses. She did a lot of things that normal children were able to do. She didn't let that hold her back. So when her family moved to another town, she came to know the landlady quite well. And this woman, their landlady, helped Fanny learn to start memorizing the Bible. And she was so quick to learn. This is where you really see her take off, is she had the most amazing memory. She was often able to master 5 chapters of the Bible a week. And so eventually, Fanny came to know, this is crazy, the entire Pentateuch, the Gospels, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and many Psalms by heart. That's crazy. But, you know, I mean, she put, you know, her mind to good use, and, you know, she wasn't distracted by what she was seeing around her, so she was able to really focus in. I love that. No wonder she said, "All that I am, all that I ever expect to be in literature or in life is due to the Bible." So in 1835, she was 15 years old, and she entered a new school called the New York Institute for the Blind. I think that's where, isn't that where, like, Laura Ingalls went, or not, Mary, or whatever, and remember in Little House on the Prairie when she goes blind? I think they send her off to that institute, because at the time, I mean, there wasn't a lot available for blind people. So she taught and studied and taught there for the next 23 years, and her memory really came in handy here, because Braille hadn't been invented yet, so they had to just kind of memorize a bunch of stuff. It was pretty crazy. So during her time at the school, she really honed her poetry and writing skills, and she became known for this. Because she had a very charming personality and was such an excellent worker, she became kind of the representative of the institution, and through that, she was able to meet a lot of great men and women of her day, including 3 U.S. presidents, Polk, Van Buren, and Grover Cleveland, who later wrote to her and said, "It is more than 50 years ago that our acquaintance and friendship began, and ever since that time, I have watched your continuous and disinterested labor in uplifting humanity and pointing out the way of appreciation of God's goodness and mercy." So, I mean, pretty amazing what the Lord launched her into. In 1858, she married a fellow student and professor at the Institute. In 1864, she wrote her first hymn at the suggestion of a songwriter who really loved her poems. And through this, she was brought into contact with this publishing company that made a contract with her to basically write poems that would be turned into hymns and stuff like that. I'm going to skip that part. Not only were her hymns used to encourage and strengthen the body of Christ, but they were extremely useful for evangelism. So D.L. Moody, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the evangelist, he and Ira Sankey actually used a lot of Fanny Crosby's hymns in their evangelistic crusades and led a lot of people to Christ. And that was important to Fanny. She actually said, "I determined that many people will read a song who would not read a sermon," which is true. A lot of people will hear a song, but they're not going to go, if you say, "Oh, we're going to go listen to a preacher," they'd be like, "Oh, heck no." But they would come to a concert, right, or listen to songs. And so God really used her in evangelism in that way. In her later years, she became an active public speaker. She would go and work with the poor in big cities. And through it all, she just thanked the Lord for her blindness. And I love this quote. She said, "It seemed intended by the blessed providence of God that I should be blind all my life, and I thank him for the dispensation. If perfect earthly sight were offered me tomorrow, I would not accept it. I might not have sung hymns to the praise of God if I had been distracted by the beautiful, interesting things around me." What an amazing perspective. And I really believe that if we choose to walk with the Lord through even the most bitter and difficult trials that we face, then we would have that perspective as well. I even remember Molly saying that on Friday, Molly Kelly, when she shared on Friday morning a couple weeks ago about the fact that she just went through a gnarly season with her health, but she wouldn't trade it because she sees the fruit that the Lord has, you know, brought out of her life as a result. And I can say the same of the hardest things in my life that I've gone through. I wouldn't trade them, even though I wouldn't want anybody else to experience it, but I wouldn't trade it because of what the Lord has done in me as a result. And so I think just what a beautiful perspective to have, to look at those trials as sources of unexpected blessing. She died February of 1915 at the age of 95. And how amazing, the first thing that Fanny saw since she was 6 months old was her Lord and Savior, right? And she kind of expresses that in one of her hymns, Saved by Grace. I think this was probably on her mind, that moment when she would go to heaven. She said, "Someday the silver cord will break, and I no more as now shall sing. But oh, the joy when I shall wake within the palace of the king, and I shall see him face to face and tell the story, saved by grace." So her life was one of joy and hope in the midst of what could have been difficult, bitter disappointment and trial. And I believe that's why her hymns were so powerful. One of her co-writers said, "There was probably no writer in her day who appealed more to the valued experience of the Christian life or who expressed more sympathetically the deep longings of the heart than did Fanny Crosby." And so her perspective on her trials bore incredible fruit. She once said, "Where selfishness is, there happiness cannot be found." That's very, very true. That's a good zinger. Where selfishness is, their happiness cannot be found. And many of us have impediments. We have issues that we think disqualify us or that we allow to hold us back. And so we would do well to heed such words from a lady who had every reason to be downcast, every reason to complain, every reason to say, "The world done me wrong." But she chose instead to live for the glory of God. It really is about our perspective. So in closing, I've thought a lot lately of Psalm 47:4, where it says, "He will choose our inheritance for us, the excellent of Jacob whom he loves." And we've just looked at several people in various walks of life, all with very unique circumstances. But what do they all have in common? They allowed, They allowed God to choose their inheritance for them. They allowed God to have his way in their lives. They made themselves and their gifts available for his purposes, right? They allowed him to choose their inheritance for them. And what fruit they bore as a result. And so hopefully, if nothing else, we're all encouraged to do the same. Knowing, like it says, that he loves us. I love that. It says, "He will choose our inheritance for us, the excellence of Jacob, whom he loves." God, when God makes his choices for us, they're based on his great, great love for us. And so we can trust that if we allow him to choose our path for us, choose our inheritance for us, the things that he's going to do in our lives, we can trust that he's going to choose the absolute best, whatever that ends up being, as we surrender and allow him to use those things in whatever walk of life we're in, whatever our sphere of influence or our circle. So let's pray. Lord Jesus, thank you for these ladies. Thank you for their patience with me. As I tried to bust through all of this, God, I just pray, Lord, that we would have those hearts and lives that are just yielded to you because you love us so much, God. You know us better than anyone. How do we not trust you more, God, with the places you have placed us, the gifts you have given us, the circumstances we face, even the problems that we encounter and the things we think disqualify us or make us not good enough or whatever. God, help us to set all of those things aside and to look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, and to really just pursue you and pursue whatever path you put before us with all our hearts, Lord, and allow you to move and to work. Who knows what you would be able to do, Lord, with each and every life in here. There's so much potential for what you want to do in our spheres of influence, whatever they are, whether they're small or huge in our eyes, it doesn't matter, God, if we're walking with you and yielded to what you have for us. So we love you, Lord. Thank you so much for this time. In Jesus' name.